were talking about the character of the different firms. I suppose what I was getting at was there anything distinctive? Say, I mean, was Wed a very different firm from Pynchon, or a very different firm from Biscuit, or did they more or less all project themselves as similar?
Well, the three you mentioned, in actual fact, were three of the biggest firms in the market, and therefore they had that aura about them. But in terms of character, I mean, it was the individuals themselves that gave the character. And there were certain, I mean, I remember when I first went into the market, Mr. Percy Duke, you may have heard of him already. And as a blue button, if you ask him a question, you were expected to stand to attention. And if you needed a haircut, he'd certainly tell you. But he was one of the characters, and much loved, although much feared by some of the younger men. But there were characters on every pitch, and there were the guys you knew that you could get a friendly reception from, and there were others where you thought you might get a frosty reception, depending on their mood at the time, because they're only human, jobbers and brokers, and they had their ups and downs, and if they'd had a bad day, they were likely to be a bit offhand with you. So, no, but by and large, it was a great place for character building and for characters themselves. Mm. And we had many of those on the market floor, and we used to expect at certain times of the year happenings related to just having a bit of fun. Mm. But certain people you always knew would be at the behind that sort of activity on the market floor.
Mm. The 60s was a period when a lot of jobbing firms were either liquidating, going out, stopping, ceasing trading, or merging. Was that something that you were conscious of as a stock market reporter?
No, it wasn't, because to be honest, I don't think that's absolutely true. Mm. I don't remember many occasions in those days. I mean, we had I remember the horrible sound of the hammer in the old market floor. But to my knowledge, in my experience, I only heard that twice. Mm. And when the waiter stood up and made this hammering noise, the whole market, which was alive with noise at all times, would come to, there would be a deathly hush. Mm. And he would announce that such and such a firm cannot meet its commitments, and therefore was being suspended. That was a dreadful sound and much feared. And it still is today. Mm. But, of course, we don't get the physical aspect of the hammering these days. Mm. And it was a very rare occurrence, mm. and one that made everybody very unhappy for a while.
Yes.
But you just got on with the job at the end of the day.
Yes. What I meant was simply senior partners deciding that it was time for them to retire and closing the firm down, and maybe some of their dealers going to a firm like Ackroyd or Wed.
Yeah.
Or firms simply merging, like the big one, Wed and Durlacher. Mm-hmm. Do you think that made a difference to the stock exchange?
Well, I suppose it made a difference, but not a very obvious one. Mm-hmm. Things went on as usual day to day.
Yes.
And it's not like today where we have the huge operations. Sometimes governed by outside sources, where you have leading market makers who were very good jobbers prior to Big Bang, who frankly are very frustrated since they are not allowed to conduct the business as they think it should be conducted because of outside interference. And when I say outside interference, I mean if the outside interferer is a company, say an American company, who's put a lot of money into a market-making operation, and it is very conscious of the fact that it doesn't want to lose money on it. It will be in a situation where it will say to its leading market makers at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you've got too many so-and-so shares on the book, cut them. In other words, it's knocked out a bit of the entrepreneurial spirit of the old jobbing system, where a leading jobber might have 3 million shares of GEC on the book overnight. And he'd keep those, thinking to himself, well, all things being equal, the market will be better tomorrow, I might make a couple of coppers on those. And that's how he operated. But nowadays, having a large position overnight is not welcomed or encouraged, especially by the overseas bosses, if you like, because of the markets worldwide now are so volatile that you could have a nasty loss on that particular share. So they don't encourage that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you've dampened the entrepreneurial spirit of those jobbing, the real jobbers in the old days who used to make good money.
Mm-hmm. Did the style of jobbing actually change? For example, one of the things that's occasionally been said is that, whereas in the early days, turning over your book was the basic aim of a jobber, in latterly, position taking and carrying stock for a much longer period, simply, I suppose, because of the size of bargains that they were being asked to deal in, became much more important or became a greater fact of life.
Yes, it's at the end of the day, it's all about money. Running a bear position in the old jobbing days was very useful because it meant that you didn't have to fund a position overnight. Running bear positions recently have seen tremendous losses for the major jobbing, the major market makers, because the problem with running a bear position is that, of course, you never know the extent of your loss. Mm-hmm. And the way that works is that very few people want to sell on a rising market. And if, as a market maker, you're for some reason or other got a short book in a certain stock and the whole market is rising and you bid up for that stock to get it back on your book, the potential seller will say to himself, well, the market's rising, no, I won't sell them yet. So he's out on a limb. So he's got to, if he wants to close that bear position, he's got to keep bidding higher to get the stock, to persuade somebody to sell them to him. And of course, human nature being what it is, the greed syndrome, when the market's rising, as I say, nobody wants to sell. So you can get in an awfully expensive position running a bear. Prior to Big Bang, you could still lose money being a bear, of course. But at least you seem to have more opportunity. You knew, you saw more people and you put bids out to all and sundry on the market floor. You had a sort of greater spread of potential dealers, I think, anyway. And a lot of this is personal opinion, you know. You get people all around the market. My view is that if you conducted an anonymous poll of all the leading market makers, they would almost certainly say they would prefer a return to the market floor than to carry on with the current system. But bearing in mind that so much money has been invested in the current system, and eventually it will pay off, albeit with a smaller number of market makers, nobody wants to say that publicly, and you can understand that. But you talk to many of the old stagers who are still around in the broking houses, who are just agency brokers, and they'll all say to you, give us that chance, we'd be back on the floor tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel before 86 that some of the jobbing firms, or perhaps even the broking firms, were too big or too powerful for their own good, in the sense that they, because often they were the market in a particular stock, that a lot of people didn't have much choice about who they went to deal with?
Well, they've got even less choice today in that sense. Mm. Certainly there were, if you were a broker on the market floor, you had your knowledge of the biggest jobbers in particular stocks. So you knew if you had a large order, you would really have to go to one of those, the top three or four in that particular stock. If you had a small order, you could job it around with the smaller people in the market and on a friendly basis, possibly get a better price. At the end of the day, it was a matter of individual choice for the broker concerned. But he would know what he was doing, and he would know where he could serve his client's best interests in that dealing form.
I've mentioned some of the firms that were successful right through to Big Bang, but of course there are a lot of firms that didn't quite make it and disappeared over time, a firm called Kitchen Baker Shaw, which disappeared in the mid-60s, or Francis and Prague, which was a big gilt jobber that went out in the early 70s. Blackwell & Co., which were all jobbers, Stockton and Lazarus, which were international mining. Did any of the disappearance of some of these firms seem to make much of an impression at the time? Are all those names now more or less forgotten? And
well, nowadays, yes, they're more or less forgotten. Mm. But of course, anybody over 50 around the city would remember those names and look back and say, why did they go for one reason or another? I mean, it might just have been that the senior partners decided that it was time to retire and they wanted to get some money out, to live on.
Mm.
And so they sold the business or whatever.
Yes.
But I don't think that it made a particular impression, not like it does today, where there's so much more money involved. Mm. That a decision by a market maker to retire from the scene obviously creates speculation that particular market maker has lost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, it's all about money, and big losses and big gains always attract publicity.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you a few questions about relations between jobbers and brokers, because, as we know, the whole sort of idea underpinning single capacity was that there would be no conflict of interest, it made for an efficient market. Did you ever think there were situations where brokers did get too close to jobbers and would tend to do most of their dealing with particular jobbers, or even in a takeover situation where the jobbers were in effect, well, the broker was in effect working in tandem with the particular jobber?
Well, you're talking about pre-Big Bang.
Yes, certainly.
Pre-Big Bang, of course, when you were, all brokers had their particular friends in the market in the jobbing world. Mm-hmm. And quite often this went on a social basis outside the market, which is natural enough when you're working with people. And you had a situation where if you were a broker and you wanted a deal in a certain stock where one of your particular friends was on the jobbing book, naturally you'd give him a chance.
Mm.
And I mean, that was all part of it, and there was nothing wrong in that. It was just natural, and a friendly atmosphere developed as a result. So there could be a time when a broker was limited on a price by his client, and the jobber, say, wasn't bidding as much as the client wanted. If it was only a small amount, there could be times when the jobber would say, well, I'll put it down if your client insists that that's what he wants.
Mm.
It would just be outside the market price, but it was done as a favour, because you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. It happened, and this was the sort of friendly and nice environment there was in the stock exchange before Big Bang.
Mm.
It still goes on now to a certain extent, because a lot of brokers still know the market makers very well, and although it has to be done mainly on the telephone, you've got a situation where a broker will ring up and say, hi Fred, you know, what a so-and-so today, and he'll quote a price, and the broker will say that that's a high and a low, that's not a price, and so they'll have a laugh and a joke and sometimes deal slightly different to the market screen. But the problem is, these days, for brokers, is that they're so exposed through the screen system. Because if you're a broker and you want a deal in a sizable amount of a certain stock, an alpha stock, and you punch it up on the screen, and you'll see seven or eight market makers all making a price in that same stock. And one of the market makers is slightly different, perhaps a penny cheaper on the sell side. And you as a broker want to buy some for a client. Now you'll pick up the telephone and ring the cheapest offer guy. He immediately knows you're a buyer. You're so exposed. That doesn't mean to say he won't deal with you, because he might be prepared to offer the stock at slightly cheaper than the other market makers. But this is the disadvantage, because prior to Big Bang, of course, on the market floor, you as a broker would go along to the jobber and you'd ask a price, and he had no idea whether you were a buyer or a seller.
Mm.
And to that extent, things are much more difficult these days,
mm.
especially for the broker who's trying to deal for small clients.
Mm. How often pre-Big Bang would you get a situation where virtually all the jobbers in a particular stock were quoting the same price. Because this is something that's occasionally been said to me by brokers.
Yes. Well, it happened, of course, but I mean, it was just a question of whipping around the market and trying to do the best you could. And if they were all quoting the same price and nobody would come in, even on a friendly basis, you either had to accept the price or you didn't deal. But in most cases, you could usually get a bit inside with somebody if it was a marketable stock. When I say a marketable stock, one that was freely traded, not some, you know. There was a wonderful pitch on the old market floor run by Durlacher, which was called Treasure Island. I don't know if you've been told about this before. But this was run by several senior dealers, and other people used to describe it as the rubbish stock ball, but it wasn't the rubbish stock ball, but it was a lot of odds and ends that couldn't be classified directly under, say, engineering or electricals, but a company, smaller companies usually, which were had bits and pieces of this, like small, I'm trying to think of the name, just the smaller companies which had a big spread of interest, which you couldn't classify under one heading. And that pitch was called Treasure Island, and it dealt in, I should think, 500 stocks. And you could always find people clustered around that and trying to deal inside and usually getting some sort of service and satisfaction. Mm. Because it was a fun place, that's why it was called Treasure Island. But at the same time, it was quite serious dealing. Mm.
Were shop brokers very important elements in the market, in the sense that the broker to the company? In providing liquidity in a stock?
Well, I think those days you had a situation where a jobber, if he was short of stock, would say to the company broker, any chance are you letting him have a bit, old boy? And things used to happen like that. Mm. And I suspect it still goes on today to a certain extent. But you see, prior to Big Bang, dealings by and large were smaller in size than they are these days. I mean, we're talking big numbers these days a lot. When you see the active stocks list on any particular day, you get a printout on the computer, and you'll see there's 15 million or 25 million traded in a certain share. I mean, that sort of activity used to go on occasionally, but of course it wasn't recorded. Nobody really knew prior to Big Bang. And I suspect that in general terms it was much smaller than happens today, because we've got this international market and we have American, Japanese, European investors who are prepared to put big money in. And this is why the Big Bang was set up, of course, to make London, it was already probably the best recognised international centre, but it wasn't the biggest in terms of volume, and now it's getting to that stage. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever think much trading went on personal account? I mean, this was something that was a sort of grey area, that there was no reason.
Prior to Big Bang, everybody on the stock market floor used to deal PA, and then buy a few shares in this. And I mean, when I first went in 1959, the popular term was £3.2 and 6. And you'd buy a certain share, and you'd sell it 10 minutes later and take £3.2 and 6. 3.26 was the term. Then, of course, as inflation increased, that got to be a bigger sum. Mm. But no, everybody in those days, it was pretty open house in terms of dealers dealing on their own account. That wasn't, not to say they were encouraged to do insider trading, but I mean, when you're working in an environment like that, you can see what's happening, you can feel what's happening, and you could say, I just fancy the market to go better this afternoon, perhaps Wall Street might come in a bit better, let's buy a couple of thousand ICI or whatever, and hope in an hour's time to sell them and take £15, £20 profit or whatever it was at the time. And everybody used to deal PA on the market floor. When I say everybody, but I mean nearly everybody. And it was certainly not discouraged, Nowadays, it's very much discouraged, and people, especially in the market making firms, have to get permission from their clearance people to deal on personal account.
Mm. Is that was that a sort of feature of the post Big Bang era? That era, this the necessity to get permission and a very careful supervision.
Oh, yes, indeed. When you're dealing in bigger numbers, you've got to take bigger responsibility, and you've got to protect that responsibility as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Hence a situation where we have recorded telephone calls, mainly to, in case you get a bargain query. I mean, on the market floor prior to Big Bang, if you went up to a certain jobber and say, I'll buy X so-and-so share from you, that would go through the checking department between the two firms. And sometimes it happened that the checking man found that the jobber had bought them when you sold them. And so you used to go back to him with a checking query, and you'd get it sorted out somehow or other. And you'd say, well, I said this, and he'd say, no, you didn't, you said that. But they'd sort it out somehow. But nowadays, with the recorded with the recorded messages, all you've got to do is press the tape, and you can say, there you are, I did buy them, I didn't sell them. That sort of thing.
Mm.
So that's, and of course also it's part of the surveillance business of keeping an eye on people. It's become more important to keep an eye on things to stop any real trouble going on.
During the late 70s, I believe a certain amount of tension began to develop between the jobbers and the brokers over the greater number of put-throughs being done. And things like price agreements that the jobbers would occasionally have in particular stocks. Does that ring any bells for you? Would you ever have, for example, jobbers coming to you complaining about what, you know, particular brokers were doing or what brokers were doing generally? Or?
No, by and large, they were in little internal rows that took place between the two parties, and it'd all be forgotten the following day in the cut and thrust of things. And in general terms, the business wasn't really big enough to get too upset about.
Mm.
But you've got the occasional row between a broker and a jobber, but usually it was all smoothed over, and in a couple of days it was all forgotten, and you're back to square one again.
Mm.
I didn't see, Big Bang, I never saw any real evidence of what I would call big upsets.
Mm. Did you ever get the impression that brokers occasionally wanted to cut the jobbers out and then sort of job their own stocks or basically match business?
Well, of course, the facilities really didn't exist for that as they do today.
Mm.
I'm not saying, I mean, the situation is that a broker would sometimes get a buy order from one client and a sell order from another one. But what he would do in that case, prior to Big Bang, he would go into the market to a jobbing friend and who dealt in that particular share. And he would say, I want to buy these at that and I want to sell them at that. And they would the jobber would be happy because he's done a bargain with a perhaps a smaller jobber's commission, but at least he's done it without any problems. You know, it's there and done. And the other side is quite happy because the buyer probably bought a little cheaper and the seller got a shade more because of that deal. And that's the way it was done, and fairly satisfactory in the old days.
Mm.
Not quite so these days when the numbers are that much bigger.
Mm.
I keep coming back to this, but this is what we've got to contend. The market is a completely different place now than it was then.
Mm. Well, let me ask you a few questions about what you could describe as the sort of the wider stock market, in the sense of the bringing in the clients and the outside financial institutions like the merchant banks. Strictly speaking, the jobber was meant to stay in the four walls of the stock exchange and not have any contact with the people outside. Did you ever get the impression that jobbers occasionally did have contacts with outside clients in an informal way, you know, fund managers or institutional investors?
I have no evidence of that, to be honest, but I can only say that in the normal run of things, in the friendliness of the city as a whole, there must have been examples like that. And there were also some suspicion, of course, so that some people's cards were marked occasionally. But that's the same the world over. And, you know, there's nobody deals in anything unless they think they know something the other guy doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the big speculative operators who've now given up trading say to me that it's just not worth dealing because if you get one right out of 10, there's sometimes an inquiry and you might find that the bargain is cancelled because there is a suspicion you knew something inside. But they would argue they don't take into account the 9 I lost money on. So, you know, it swings and roundabouts a bit, but you will find that the big speculative trader who used to operate before the insider trading laws really became tough, no longer trades. Not because he's got particularly insider information, but because, for one thing, the operation of the market isn't conducive to the sort of business that he does or did. Because he, as I said before, he might deal 5 or 6 times a day in 5 or 6 different things. And he'd take a profit on 2 or 3 and perhaps a loss on the others. But that was his form of gambling as opposed to gambling on the horses. It was just a fun thing, and hopefully he'd make money on it. But at the end of the day, it wasn't that serious.
Did you ever get an impression that there was much of a market going on outside of the stock exchange, in the sense of institutions dealing with merchant banks in American stocks or gold stocks or whatever, or even institutions dealing between themselves?
I wasn't really in a position to see any of that, so I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I'm sure it did go on in some form or other, but I suspect that tales were slightly exaggerated.
What was the feeling in the stock exchange too? Things like spread agreements and the sort of informal jobbers committee that the jobbers set up themselves during the late 70s, early 80s. Do those in any way in your experience as a journalist?
Well, as a stock market reporter, I wasn't really privy to many of the sort of insider-type things that went on. When I say insider, I mean inside the stock exchange walls, as it were.
Yes.
I really saw no real evidence of any problems over price agreements or whatever.
Mm.
It just didn't come up in my sphere of operation. So I don't believe that there were many problems associated with that because, as I say, in the old days, people used to get on well together and they always had a situation where they could sort it out over a cup of coffee or whatever.
Mm.
And I don't think that I can make any real comment on that because I wasn't privy to the information, as I say.
Now, the referral of the Stock Exchange rulebook to the Restrictive Practices Court put the Stock Exchange under a spotlight caused the whole way of trading to be examined, and eventually led to the demise of single capacity. As a stock market reporter, did you ever feel that there were any pressures on single capacity simply as a way of trading before Big Bang, quite apart from the OFT case? Did it ever seem to be a system that was under strain? And that the stock market as a whole was suffering?
I would say that single capacity prior to Big Bang worked perfectly well. Mm-hmm. There were never any real problems with it. In my humble opinion, the whole idea of dual capacity was based on a sort of almost a greed syndrome where people wanted to get bigger and bigger and needed the advantages of both sides, broking and jobbing, under the same roof. But as I say, I personally think that was a retrograde step.
Mm.
But some people would agree and some wouldn't.
Mm.
But all I can tell you is that prior to Big Bang, the stock exchange dealing system used to work and work well. And the subsequent complaints about, especially from smaller investors, about the problems associated post Big Bang might lead you to the view that under some circumstances the old system was better than the new.
One of the things that was said about the jobbers in particular was that they were basically undercapitalized in relation to the size of business that they were increasingly be asked to do, and perhaps not so much the Aykroyds or the Weds, but firms at the sort of second tier level, like the Pynchons or the Bisgoods and so on. Does that strike you as a sort of valid?
Well, I suspect they were undercapitalized in today's terms, but in the under the conditions and the that they were working at the time, I don't think they were. I mean, they had even the medium or even the smaller size firms had adequate banking facilities. Mind you, interest rates weren't always 15%. And in those days, of course, we didn't have a situation where the stock exchange watchdogs were keeping a very close watch on the actual liquidity of the stock exchange firms themselves and have put down a minimum requirement. I imagine there were times, sometimes prior to Big Bang, when several smaller stock exchange firms, for instance, were at times out of the money, as it were. But they weren't hammered, and they got it back eventually because they've got decent banking arrangements and so on. And